Yeah.
It works.
Yeah.
Good. Okay, we've got one more minute, so we'll just wait for a couple of minutes so everyone can come in. So, okay, it's 3:30 now. So, I'm Ajahn Brahm from I don't know where, because I travel around so much. When people ask me where I live, I usually say I live in an aircraft, because that's where I spend most time. And today I am giving a talk on dealing with difficult people. And it's a very nice poster on all these difficult people you have to deal with. But just talking a few minutes ago, they said one of the most difficult people to deal with is your wife. If you're a man, and if you're a wife, a woman, of course, dealing with your husband. And if you're gay, dealing with your partner, it's all the same. So, we have developed a very new method of having a harmonious marriage. If any of you are married, or thinking of getting married, this actually works. And it is very, very simple. Because when you have discussions, you know, in a marriage, it's really, really disappointing when your partner always has to be right. And you can't both be right all of the time, but so we try and share being right, and then everybody is happy. So the method is called the calendar method. And it works like this. If you're having an argument at home with your partner, you can't, doesn't matter how long you argue, doesn't matter how much evidence you produce, it does not matter how many facts are there in front of your partner, you still can never prove that you're right and your partner is wrong. So the calendar method is how to solve those arguments. When you're having an argument, you look at the date. If it is an odd day of the month, she's right. If it's an even day of the month, he's right. And that means it's fair. And it means you don't have to keep arguing and wasting time and spoiling your marriage, because you never get anywhere that way. So instead, you just look at the calendar. What day is it today, by the way? It's 7th of May. So today, the girls are right. But be careful, ladies, because tomorrow, he'll be right. That means we don't have this terrible idea that he is always right or she is always right. And what is more important, being right or having a happy family and being in love? Which would you prefer? And the problem is, of course, we want to be in love. We want to have a happy relationship. We know we can't always be right. And as long as it's fair. And for you women, I think you should have already figured out there are more odd days in the year than even ones. So you're ahead of the game. But guys, for peace and quiet, it's worth it. Give it to them. So, what we're doing here is understanding that arguments are actually, they are solvable, as long as we don't always think that they are right, or we are right. We can always find another way when we have higher priorities. The trouble with arguments is that we think being right is the most important. And this all comes from the time we went to school, when if we made a mistake, we were punished, scolded, saying that somehow we were inferior because we are wrong. And that has come in your whole life. Being wrong is something which is almost detestable for you. And it just becomes, you know, the idea of our ego to actually to get on in the world, we always have to be right. And it's wonderful to understand that this has been conditioned into you, you know, from your education, from your parents, from your friends, always having to be right. Because if we are wrong, it looks like that there's something bad about us, something inferior, some mistake in us. But you all know that it's okay to be wrong in life. It's wonderful to make mistakes. And because of that, I like celebrating mistakes. And I like telling myself and others about all the mistakes which I've made in the last year. One of these, in case you haven't heard this before, one of my best mistakes was when I was doing a marriage blessing. That's part of my job as a Buddhist monk. And I was really tired. And when I gave the blessing, you know, in the Pali language, I was so tired I gave the wrong blessing. I gave the blessing for the funerals at the marriage. And of course, no one noticed because it's in Pali. That's one of the reasons why the monks in here in Thailand, we chant in Pali. So if we make a mistake, you guys don't know. So I did make a mistake. I chanted the funeral chant at a marriage. And you know, they're still married. It didn't matter. But I told everybody. And so these days, when I've told so many people now, when I do a marriage ceremony, they always say, Ajahn Brahm, remember this is a marriage. Please do the right chanting. And there was another case. I was doing a funeral service for somebody. It was for a Sri Lankan disciple. And are there any Sri Lankans here? No, okay. You know, they have very long names, which are very hard to pronounce. And I knew the disciple's name, so when he said, you know, one of his parents had passed away, you know, I said, okay, yes, I'll do the funeral service for them. And so I went to it was a chapel, you know, it was interfaith chapel, multi-religious chapel. And I went in there and I got on the microphone and said, we've come here today to pay respects, you know, for, you know, my disciples. I knew his names, for his mother who just passed away very tragically. And then a few seconds later, this old woman stood up in the front and she said, it's not me who's dead, it's my husband. Another mistake. Well, there's a 50-50 chance and I got the wrong one. But anyway, I make mistakes and I tell everybody about it and it makes you laugh. And it makes me more relaxed. I don't have to be right every time. And in fact, I make it a rule, you know, in the monastery which I lead, to say it's all right, it's allowable to make mistakes. And when you're allowed to make mistakes, when you realize you are imperfect, you don't have to be right. It means people admit their mistakes more often, which means we don't have so many arguments. And also that if you are allowed to make mistakes, you find that you don't make so many. There is something in life which I have developed called the 70% rule. And this came about from the time before I was a monk, when I was a teacher at high school. For 1 year I taught teenagers in a high school in the West. And I often say that if any of you have ever taught teenagers, it would make you think of becoming a monk or a nun. They are very difficult. So I became a monk, but when I was a school teacher, I had to set an exam in math. And this was the first time I'd ever set an exam, so I went to a senior teacher to ask for advice. And his advice was, do not set the exam to too hard a level, because if your students score an average of 30%, 40%, they will lose their motivation. And they will think they can't do math, that math is too difficult. And so they will do something else in school later on. But if you make the exam too easy, so they all get 95%, 100%, again, that's too easy. And the exam has no meaning. So he told me to try and aim for 70%. So if the average score is 70%, it means that all of your children, the students, they will come away thinking, yes, we can do math. And the most important is the 30% where they make mistakes. That is where I, as their teacher, can learn their weak points and address those weak points in my next lessons. So the 30% where they fail is where I can teach them so they can learn and grow and become better in that subject. And the 70% which is right is to encourage them, to motivate them, to make them feel good. And I realize that that is the same in life. If you score 100% in life or 95%, you have a wonderful life but you don't learn anything. If you score 30%, 40%, then you get depressed, even suicidal. You think you're hopeless and can't do anything. But if in life you score 70%, in other words, you're not perfect, you make some mistakes, then that, to me, is perfection, the best life. Because it means that where you make mistakes, that is where you learn and grow and become a better human being afterwards. Mistakes are not to be avoided. They're not to be covered up. They're not to be just say, I don't make mistakes. Mistakes are where we learn. They're part of life. They're important as long as it's about 30%. So if you have got like a husband who's 100%, dump him. He won't learn anything. If he's 70%, that's the very, very best. So you can see that this is how we understand mistakes. And mistakes are acceptable, which means that people don't get so difficult to deal with. Now, because a lot of time, you know what it's like dealing with a difficult person. They're always right. They always have to get their own way. And they will never listen to anybody. And those sorts of people, I know from Buddhist psychology how to deal with them. They're not that hard to deal with if you understand how the mind works. For example, you may have a difficult boss in this organization. And, you know, you're not being, say, paid enough. You need a rise in your salary. How do you get the raise in your salary? If there are any bosses here, could you please leave the room? It's so simple. It comes from an experience when I first went to Australia as a monk, and I was number 2 monk. I had a boss who was senior to me. And he was very difficult to deal with, if you didn't know how to deal with difficult people. So we were building this monastery, and I would suggest to him, why don't we build a hut on the hill over there? And he would say, no, that's a stupid idea, it won't work, don't be ridiculous. You know what happens when you suggest a good idea to bosses? How they always reject it? For the only reason that they're the boss and you are under them. So you can't have good ideas. So this is what this monk said. Now I knew how to deal with this. I said, okay, never mind. I never argued. Never argue. You just say, okay, boss. The boss says, no, you can't have a rise. We can't afford it. Okay. And then 2 weeks later, when I knew he'd forgotten what I'd said, I'd reinforce the message. I'd say, on the hill over there, why don't we build a hut on the hill over there? He'd repeat it. No, that's a silly idea. You can't do that. It's a waste of time. All right. And I would not argue again. Because I knew once I had said that idea, I knew it had gone into his subconscious. And it was working its way through. And it worked every time. Maybe I would reinforce it one more time, but usually twice was enough. And then he'd come and see me. He said, you know, I have just had an idea that we should build a hut on the hill over there. And because he's a boss, you always say, "Wow, what a great idea of yours, boss." And that is how you get your own way with a boss. So you can tell your boss, "Boss, you know, I don't think I'm being paid enough for the amount of work I do." He said, "Oh, I can't afford it." No, don't argue. Shut up. You've already put the seed into his brain. Wait for a couple of weeks, reinforce it. "Boss, you know, it's, you know, people who do the same work as me, you know, get this salary, so I should get it as well." "No, silly, we can't afford it. I can't do that." Forget it. And then you will be surprised how often this works. Your boss will come and say, "No, I've been thinking. I think you deserve more pay for what you do." And you say, "Wow, you're such a kind boss. How on earth did you think of that?" Bosses always need to be sucked up to. And difficult people always need to be pampered. You know that psychology. In the end, you get your own way. Your idea, if it is worth anything, if it is good, you know, it comes to the forefront of their subconscious. And they become conscious of it, and then it becomes their idea. Because leaders and bosses, it has to be their idea. And I've used that a lot with difficult people. You know, but sometimes maybe you haven't got time. You know, you've got to get things done a bit quicker. So how can you deal with difficult people to get a good solution, to get a good outcome, which you know needs to be done? Now, why is it that people are difficult with you? A lot of times, you know, it's because of their ego. They have to be right. They have to be in charge. And they can't be told. They know more than anybody else. And some of those people are very angry people. And have you ever noticed that if you are really kind to somebody, and you have a very good relationship with somebody, you can always get things done? Many years ago, when I lived in Thailand, I met the former Prime Minister, Dr. Sanya Tamasak. He was a Prime Minister for 1 year, and then became an Ongamontri, you know, one of the King's advisors, the chief advisor. And he told me that while he was Prime Minister of Thailand, there was never any argument or disagreement he couldn't solve as a Prime Minister. And he said how he would solve those arguments was to go to his adversary, maybe from the other side of the political spectrum, to go to them and just sit down together, just one on one. And he said he'd put his hand on his adversary's knee. Now, if you do that in Australia, then that means you're gay. But in Thailand, it means you're a friend. So you put it on their knee, and he said that gesture of friendship meant that they could discuss things and come to a solution. There was never any problem he couldn't solve that way. And I always recall that because that's so Buddhist. If you do have some kindness, it's incredible how powerful that is. I'm now going to tell another story about one of my disciples in Sydney. She was a young woman just starting her business in the fashion industry. And she had a very supportive husband and a young child called Holly, very cute little kid, who was about 6 or 7 when this happened. And she managed to negotiate a very big contract with a retailer in UK for her fashion designs. And this was going to be the break she needed to get her company started. And so negotiating for a long time, the company emailed her to tell her, "We're ready to sign the contract. Come to London straight away." And so she had to drop everything and leave her little daughter, Holly, in Sydney and get the first available flight all the way to Heathrow. She only had time when she landed to check into her hotel, have a shower, get changed, no rest, and go to the boardroom of the company. And when she entered the boardroom of the company, she was expected. The directors were there, but no CEO yet. And as soon as she came in, the directors told her, "You have wasted your time. You might as well get on the next plane back to Sydney. The CEO is in a filthy mood. He's been shouting and angry at everybody all morning. There's no way he's going to sign your contract or any contract today. He's angry. Now, have you ever had that experience of trying to get something signed, some agreement, something settled with an angry person, with difficult people? So, this girl, Julie, I really respect her. She said, I'm not going anywhere. I've come all this way. At least I'm going to see this fella. Suit yourself, said the directors. And so this girl, she's been meditating for many years. She sat in a corner, crossed her legs, and did what we call in Buddhism, metta meditation. Some loving kindness, where you focus all of your mind on wishing all beings in the whole world to be happy and well. And you focus until it really starts to build up some energy and steam. You have this beautiful love and care for everybody coming up. Now, whatever you think of, you can develop. And so she was meditating for about 10 or 15 minutes when the CEO came in. And the CEO saw this woman he never knew sitting in this crazy position in his boardroom. And he exploded. Who's that? In my boardroom, what did you think she is doing? I don't know if that was very convincing, but I don't get angry as a monk, so I'm just trying to act it out. I'm sure it probably was nothing like real anger, but I did try. What's she doing in my boardroom? And of course, she came out of her meditation. But she'd been just so calm and peaceful and happy that she just stood up and walked straight towards this angry, glaring monster of a CEO. And he was glaring at her. And she looked him in the eyes. And she told me these words came out automatically. She never thought about them. She never premeditated them. They just came by themselves. She told this angry monster of a CEO, you have such beautiful blue eyes, like my baby Holly back in Sydney. Have you ever tried that, talking to an angry guy? You have such beautiful blue eyes, like my baby Holly in Sydney. And it was with sincerity. She wasn't trying to play around. It just came out by itself. And she told me that CEO, it's like his brain started fusing all over the place. He knows this was not what he expected. He'd never seen anything like this before. And he was dumbfounded and silent for about 2 minutes until his face changed and the next words the CEO said was, really? And the next thing he did was sign her contract. And then he went out to do something else. And then she wanted to go back to her hotel to catch up on some sleep. She'd been on a flight for about 24 hours. And she couldn't leave because she told me that all the directors surrounded her and they said, we're not going to let you go until you tell us how you did that. So that was amazing how you could turn an angry CEO into someone who was reasonable and get your contract signed, your business done. Because look, if you're really upset and angry, and, you know, you get anger back, there's no way you're going to cooperate with anybody. The first thing you need to do is to soften a person down, to make them calm. When they're soft and calm, you can do anything with them. That's how I get all my donations from my monastery. Soften people, calm them down. And when they're nice and soft and calm, I am very sneaky as a monk. And then they want to help you. So this is one of the things, to dealing with difficult people, to calm them down, first of all. And I would say this morning, that sometimes it's quite easy to calm a person down if you know just how to use your speech. Because now, many of you may go to listen to speeches here, and sometimes they're so boring, not because the subject matter isn't interesting, because people don't know how to give a presentation. And I think you've already noticed that I change the inflection of my speech. Sometimes I raise it up and sometimes I lower it down. And when you change the speed of your speech and the tone of your speech, it makes it interesting. Which is why that people can actually enjoy the talk. It keeps them awake. And that's really important. And every now and again, I tell a joke. And one of the jokes, here's a joke for you to keep you awake. I don't know if you've heard this joke. It's a joke about marriage. Actually, the last marriage ceremony I performed, I told this joke to the happy couple. I'm very cheeky as a monk. I say, marriage is like a pack of playing cards. It starts off with hearts and a diamond. And it finishes up with clubs and looking for a spade. Are you allowed to laugh at the UN? Very good. So, you know, sometimes it's difficult, but you can work it through in a marriage. So sometimes, if someone is really angry at you, how can you use your speech? You will notice that when they're angry at you, and you're dealing with a very difficult person, they will raise their voice, and they will speak very fast. So, if I'm getting angry at you, I'm going to speak very fast and raise my voice, and that makes you very upset and angry, and it lifts your blood pressure, and everything gets very, very exciting. And how do you deal with a person like that? That when it's your turn to speak, you speak in a very soft voice, low tone, and very slowly. Can you feel how that is calming you down? And one of the other tricks of dealing with an angry person is actually pausing after they've finished shouting at you. Pause for a little while. We call that the 5 second of reflection. Because usually what happens, if you have an argument, they finish what they have to say, and then you say what you want to say. You jump in so fast, which means they don't have a chance to reflect on what they've said and how they've behaved. So, imagine that somebody has been arguing with you, and you pause for 5 seconds. In those 5 seconds, they can't listen to you because you're not saying anything. The only thing they can be aware of, be mindful of, is what they've just said and how they've said it. And it gives them the 5 seconds of reflection to realize just how unskillfully they've used their speech. And that will often soften and change them. And after a while, they won't act like that again. If you have a difficult person at home, maybe a husband or a wife, who's always shouting and shouting and shouting, you know, they don't realize that they're angry. It's amazing. They say, I'm not angry. I never get angry. And I'm going to kill anyone who says I'm angry. Now, they are angry, but they don't realize it. So one method which, you know, I've been encouraging people to do, as a young girl this morning, her father gets angry. I said, it's very easy. Take out your smartphone and take a video of your father when he's angry. And when he calms down, replay it to him. Dad, this is what you look like when you get angry. You might try that with one of your difficult bosses in this organization. And when they calm down, boss, this is what you look like. Are you going to do anything about this? And a lot of times when they see what they look like, you know, from your perspective, because they can't see it when they're getting angry, when they see what they look like, it is what we call mindfulness. You become aware of what you're doing and how you're doing it, and it really, really upsets you. But if that doesn't work, there's always a last option. Once you have the video of your boss shouting at you, and you've played it to him and he still doesn't change, then post it on YouTube.
That will
teach him to change. This is my boss in the UN. Supposed to be, you know, creating harmony and peace in the world. Because what it means is people have to see there's a problem, these difficult people. But also that, you know, once they see it's a problem, just why is it a problem? Why are there more and more difficult people in today's world? And if you haven't heard this before, this is actually fundamental to your work in United Nations. Why is there so much argument, anger, violence, conflict in our modern world? Some years ago, I was invited to a seminar for 15 to 25-year-old Buddhists in Kuala Lumpur. There's maybe about 200, 300 of them. And as part of the seminar, we asked them many questions and answered on pieces of paper. And we asked them, what is your most troublesome emotion as a 15 to 25-year-old in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia? And the answer surprised me. The most troubling emotion for 15 to 25-year-olds was tiredness. They were exhausted even when they were young. The pressure on them to do well at school and university. The pressure on them as a girl to find a partner, to be beautiful, to be popular. The pressure on guys to get a partner and to stand out. And all the pressure put on them by their parents, by their peers, was so great. They were struggling to keep ahead. They were tired. And you know where that tiredness leads. It leads to being grumpy. It leads to being angry. It leads to being a difficult person. Most difficult people are just extremely tired. They've had enough. And you come along and give me more work? This is where it comes from. Which is one of the reasons why in many organizations in our world today, they have time out rooms. Where when you do feel tired, you can take a rest. Last February, I was invited to give a talk in Google. You know, in Mountain View, the headquarters, the campus. Google has a meditation room. As soon as they find out I was in Google, Facebook, they had to get me into their campus too. And I don't know if you know Facebook, but the Facebook campus, you know, they bought so many acres of land, and they got their own campus. So they named their own road, they named their own address. And the address of Facebook headquarters in Mountain View, Silicon Valley, California is number 1 Hacker Drive. That's their address. A lot of jokesters, Hacker Drive, number 1, that's Facebook address. And anyway, they all have meditation rooms, time out rooms, rest rooms. They even have sleep pods in Google. I don't know if you've ever seen these in any documentaries about Google, little pods where, you know, it's not much space, where it is silent, dark, any time of the day you can just take a rest, take a nap. Can you do that in the UN? Can you take a nap any time of the day? Some people do, but they they do it at their desk. If you're going to take a nap, do it properly. Have a Google pod to actually take a nap in, because they do that. Because they know if you are tired and continue working, you're going to be one of these difficult people. Because of stress, tiredness, you get grumpy, angry. You're not the person who should be working in an organization like this. You're part of the problem, not the solution. So if you have a timeout room or sleep pods in this organization, anybody who's really tired, upset, go take a nap. Do some meditation, relax. And afterwards, you'll be far more open to what other people say to you. You'll be more receptive and not so negative and rejecting other people's ideas. You are more resilient. And for those people who say, we can't afford to take 15 minutes in a Google sleep pod. We can't afford to go to a meditation room for 20 minutes. That is not understanding the neurology of the human brain. Your brain, when it's tired, is very inefficient. And I'm sure that many have experienced that. Being in front of the computer screen, you've got to write some report. The ideas just do not come out. You can't think of the right word. The whole thing takes far too long. Why? It's because you're exhausted, you're tired. If you would only take 15 minutes in the Google sleep pod or 15 minutes meditating, you will be able to re-energize your brain and be able to perform. Ideas come up, letters get written, reports, you know, they're very quick and easy to write. I've been teaching this for such a long time now. It's taught in Harvard Business School. They call it an investment in the afternoon. By taking a quarter of an hour, 20 minutes out during the day when you feel tired and exhausted, you make up that 20 minutes very quickly by being more productive. Now, it's not just getting more work done in the afternoon because you've rested for 15 or 20 minutes when you're tired. It also means the quality of the work goes up. You're more open to helping other people, to listening to other people. And most importantly, when you go home, you're not such a pain in the ass to the people who have to pull up with you at home. You relax. You're a happy person. Which means that you can have a good family life as well. Simple things like that to make sure that you are not one of those difficult people. You know, difficult people are always somebody else. Okay? They're always someone else. Someone else might be you. So check on yourself. Are you really tired? And have you noticed the more tired you are, the more angry, the more difficult you are? And so understanding one of the biggest problems in our modern world is tiredness. And that causes so much conflict. And that causes just, you know, inner conflict. So we can't find solutions to problems. And overcoming that tiredness in the workplace. Just by having a place in the UN where you can just chill out for a quarter of an hour. Dell Computing has that as well. In their place, they don't call it meditation room, they call it time out room. And any worker from the top to the bottom, at any time of the day, they can just go into the time out room. And because it's a high-tech company, it is so screened, you cannot get email, you cannot get SMSs, you've got no connection at all in there. So you can relax. And in fact, just over a year ago, in the big IT conference, an annual IT conference in Silicon Valley, their conference title was called Disconnect to Connect. It was a very, very wonderful title because it was understanding that because we're always connected to our cell phones, to our tablets, to everything else, we're so connected to the internet, we have become disconnected to life. We're disconnected to ourselves, disconnected to our family, even disconnected to the people sitting next to you. There's a disconnect for a quarter of an hour, 20 minutes, to connect with yourself, to relax, rest, and then you won't be one of those tired, difficult people, you know, in this life. So, once we get to the core problem, we're having some more rest in our life. It's also, we won't have so many health problems as well. I don't know if you've ever gone into the cancer wards of modern hospitals. I remember going some years ago in Singapore, visiting someone in the cancer ward. I couldn't believe how many wards there were and how many beds. Why is there an increase of cancer? Because people are tired. The body is just worn out. Are you tired? Of course you are. You work too hard. You don't. It's not really working too hard. You don't work efficiently. When you're tired, instead of taking a break, you keep pushing through and pushing through. You use up too much energy. And that's why you become a difficult person. That's why someone was saying 50% of marriages in the United States end after 7 years? Was that the right? 7 years and 50% of marriages fail. That's terrible. Now why is that? It's because of people are so tired, struggling to get by in life. And you can still do as much work. You can still keep those big jobs if you know how to use your brain efficiently and you don't get so tired. So those are some examples of how to make sure you're not one of those difficult people. But nevertheless, there'll always be those people, you know, who are really difficult and you have to deal with them. And sometimes difficult people make you angry as well. I don't know if that happens to you. You have an argument, your boss argues with you or someone else argues with you, and you feel terrible about it afterwards. So how do you deal, you know, with the result of having a difficult person? There was once a husband who had the afternoon off work. Here comes another story. He had an afternoon off work, and his wife was cooking the dinner, and she said, "Darling, I've run out of eggs. I need some more eggs for dinner. Would you mind going to the market and getting me some eggs?" And the husband said, "Certainly, darling. Anything to help you." He wasn't doing anything that afternoon. He had the afternoon off. But he said, "I've never been to the market before. Please give me instructions." So she scribbled down a map. Told him where the egg store was and gave him some money in a basket, and off he went to help his lovely wife. But as soon as he got into the marketplace, this young man came right up to him and said, "Wow, you are so ugly. You've got a face like a camel, the back end of a camel. And I don't know what you've been using for aftershave, but it smells like dog shit." And that was only the start of being scolded and abused. And this husband, he didn't even know this young man. And he got so embarrassed being scolded in public, in the marketplace. And he was so embarrassed and upset, he turned around and went straight back home. And when he came in home, he slammed the door. And the wife said, "You're home early, darling." "Yes, I am, and I never want to go to that stupid market again. It's a terrible place. People are so uncivilized. It's a rotten place. I don't know why anyone wants to go to that market. People are so cruel." And he was really angry. And again, that wife must have listened to my talks, because she just waited until he calmed down. And speaking in a soft voice to calm him down. And then she asked, "What happened?" And when he told her about this young man, she said, "Oh, him. You know that young boy, when he was young, he had a terrible accident. He fell over, hit his head. He's brain damaged. The poor boy, because of the damage to his brain, can never go to school and have an education. He'll never find a nice girl to share his life with. He can't get a job. He's brain damaged. He just hangs around the market during the daytime. Sometimes he says the same thing to me. Even worse, he says it to everybody. But we don't mind because we know he's brain damaged. He's crazy." And as soon as the husband learnt that, all his anger vanished. How can you be upset when, you know, you've been scolded by someone who's crazy, who's got brain damage? And as soon as the wife saw that he'd calmed down totally, she said to him, "Darling, I still need those eggs." "Okay, darling, I'll go and get the eggs for you." So he went, took the basket and the money, went straight back to the market. And of course this young man saw him coming and say, Close your eyes, everybody. Here comes camel face. Hold your noses. Here comes dog poo. And it didn't matter this time. He went straight to the egg store, not embarrassed or ashamed at all. And he got his eggs from the lady, and the lady said, don't mind him, he's brain damaged. Yeah, it's such a shame, such a tragedy. And so he could take the eggs and go all the way home without any problem at all. And the moral of that story is this. If your boss shouts at you, if you go home and your wife really scolds you, then don't worry about it. Assume that she must have hit her head today. Temporary brain damage. That's why she's scolding you. How can you be upset being scolded by a brain damaged husband? And that's a wonderful way, because in Buddhism, you know, being angry is craziness. It's stupidity, how we are. It's brain damage. You're not seeing things properly. Why would you get angry at a person? So when someone's angry at you, just regard them as a brain damaged, temporarily, a crazy person. Don't take it personally. Because when they get angry at you, of course, it tells you much more about them than it ever tells you about yourself. Their anger is what you see. That's what they're telling you. When someone scolds you, tells you much more about them than anything about you. So that's how to deal with people who get angry and people who get difficult. Now, of course, you know that part of your job, I hope, in United Nations is taking difficult people together and sometimes finding some type of compromise, some way to actually to find a solution to some of the difficult problems of our world. And there is always a solution. And you know that it's incredible when you get some wise people who actually do think outside of the box. And I'm talking about outside of the box, because I can see the donation box coming up. So please think outside of the box for all the money which is outside of the box. And put it in the box. No, outside of the box. That is a way we find solutions to things. And to think outside of the box, this is another way where you have to step away from the problem to do anything else. How many times has it been in your life, you're trying to think of somebody's name, you can't think of their name, the more you think about it, the harder it is to come up. And then you go and do something else, and then the name comes up. Solutions are found when you stop thinking about it. You have the information, let it do its job. And this is one of the great advantages of doing some meditation. Now, meditation, you can be a Catholic, a Hindu, a Muslim, anybody to do meditation. It's not religious. You don't have to give up your beliefs to be a meditator. But what you do, you get another way of finding great solutions to the problems of life. I was telling people just one example, because I was a physicist at Cambridge University. There's one of the great physicists there. I'm not sure if you know him, a guy called Stephen. I forgot his name now. I better stop thinking about it. He developed Josephson, Stephen Josephson. He developed what's called the Josephson Junction. This was just how you get the same effect as in the silicon transistor thing, the diode, the same effect at very, very, very low temperatures, close to absolute zero. And when copper is at absolute zero, it has superconductivity, which means that these computers run incredibly fast. And he developed the main part of that supercomputer, which works at absolute zero, or close to absolute zero. And for that, he received the Nobel Prize in physics for developing the Josephson Junction. And he got that idea when he was meditating. He wasn't thinking of the idea. He wasn't thinking of trying to solve the problem. He'd given up, was meditating,
and the idea came to him. And that's where he got his Nobel Prize. And this is something so common. Solutions to problems don't come through thinking. Thinking or thinking inside the box. To get outside the box, be quiet, be still. And it's amazing just how much wisdom can come from stillness. So I'm encouraging more people to develop the still mind and find solutions which no one else has seen. Find ways of solving the terrible problems in this world. Everybody does have goodwill. That's one of the basics of human beings, which I've always found. Yeah, they're difficult people, but underneath that difficulty, they always want to do the right thing. They always want to make a better world. They always want to have happiness and well-being with each other. I've never seen an evil person ever in my life. And I have been in prison seeing murderers, rapists, and terrible people. But underneath all of that, they have this beautiful heart inside of them. There's always something in there. And actually, this is another thing too. Comes to my mind how to deal with difficult people. The times I have been in prisons, I've never ever yet once seen a criminal. Actually, I made a mistake earlier. I haven't seen a murderer. I haven't seen a paedophile. I haven't seen a rapist. I haven't seen a thief. All I've ever seen when I've gone into prisons are people who've committed a crime. Yeah, quite likely. But what I'm talking about here is that there is no such thing as a murderer. There's a person who was murdered. There is no such thing as a terrorist. There's a person who's done terrorist acts. But they're much bigger than those things which they are named as, those things which they're put in jail for. And whenever I've gone into jail and seen such people, and being a monk, you get to go to very interesting places, not just to Google. You go into high-security prisons as well. Because, you know, you have... It's amazing being a monk, just where you get to. And when I see these people, you see they're not criminals. They are not thieves. They are not murderers, even though they have killed many people. They are people who've murdered. In other words, I'm seeing that they're much more than the reason why they've been put in jail. And when I see that, they see it too. And when they see it, when they leave jail eventually, they never need to murder again. If they convince themselves they're murderers, then they murder again. If they convince themselves they're terrorists, then they will commit another act of terrorism. When I see that part of them, they see it in themselves. So a difficult person, there's no such thing as a difficult person. It's a person who is sometimes difficult. See if you can see the other part of them. When I gave that simile in the Singapore Institute of Mental Health, while I was giving a keynote at a conference there a couple of years ago, there was this one guy came to me and he said, "Can you bless my facility?" He was a professor, a director in the Institute of Mental Health. And I asked him, "You know, what facility do you run?" He said, "This is the schizophrenia unit." And I asked him, "How do you treat schizophrenia?" He said, "Just like you explained in your talk, I do not treat schizophrenia in a schizophrenic unit." He said, "I treat the other part of the patient." And Thai culture, as a monk, I'm not allowed to put my hands up on why lay people. But this was worthy of an exception. I put my hand up and whied him. "Brilliant. And how is your results?" He said, "Far, far better than conventional treatment." Someone with schizophrenia doesn't mean they're schizophrenic. They're a person who has that disease. Don't stigmatize them. A person is a difficult person. Are they? Or are they a person, a being, huge, complex organism called a human being, who is sometimes difficult? Maybe that's all you see about them. See if you can find something else in them. And by treating the other part of the patient, you have huge positive results. If you treat the murderer, they become a murderer. If you treat the other part of them, they become a human being again. They become rehabilitated. That's an example of thinking outside the box, seeing a bigger picture. And of course, you know, you have to deal with terrorism, terrorists. You have to deal with so many other problems, corruption. Are there any corrupt people in this organization? There are people who do corrupt things, but they are not corrupt. If you could focus on the other part of them, the corruption will probably go. Otherwise, what other alternative have you got? Have you tried the other solutions? They don't work, at least they haven't worked yet. How about trying that one? In the world, the violence. Are some of these countries violent countries? Of course they're not. They're countries with people who sometimes resort to violence, but they're not violent people. Have you ever talked to one of these top terrorists, if they are a terrorist? I was in Indonesia, I was with one of these, he's called one of the geniuses, I forget what he was. He's a child prodigy, you know, he's played the piano at Madison Square Garden. I think he's got so many degrees and so much stuff. And he's well known on the TV, a good friend of every president of Indonesia for such a long time. And on his TV show recently, he interviewed the biggest, most dangerous terrorist in Indonesia. A chat show, just the two of them. And he got the best ratings in Indonesia. And he never treated him as a terrorist. He treated them as human being. And because of that, this guy, you know, he was talking to, it was amazing, just apparently, I never saw it because I can't speak Bahasa, but it was amazing just how, when you don't treat a person as a terrorist, they show the other side of them. A really kind person who really wanted to do something good for his country, his for religion, and has resorted to that violence for some really weird reasons. Engage them first, respect them first, and you can find solutions. And apparently it was just top grossing or top rating show, and everyone was talking about it afterwards. A brilliant way of dealing with problems. Engage, listen, understand, respect. These are not bad people, these are people doing bad things. Different way of looking. It's how to deal with really difficult people. People will blow up your children, who will maim them. These are the real problems we face in our world. And there are solutions. You have to think outside the box. And sometimes the silence is where you get these new ideas. So there you go, I've been talking for an hour. I hope I've given you some new things to think about. Different ways of looking about life, different perspectives. It's getting that different perspective is how we solve problems. So, any questions?
Yeah.